lavender water to keep his complexion young and boasting about his ability to fit into women's skinny jeans, but he had a killer eye for what customers liked. I took Alan's advice and was now zipping across Lake Pontchartrain headed toward Alabama. I rolled down the windows and let the breeze play with my hair and soothe my frantic mind until the car got too warm and my hair began to frizz. On the way, I mulled over what Alan had said about burying my emotions. My first reaction was to blow it off and blame it on his constant attempts to psychoanalyze me, but he wasn't the first person to tell me I had a tough exterior. When I'd called Mitch to cancel our date on Saturday night, he called me unreadable. You break our date to one of the biggest events I have to go to all year, and you don't even seem sorry about it. I told you my grandmother died. I'll be wearing my black dress for a much more somber occasion than a fundraising gala at Galatoire's. I don't mean to slight your grandmother's death, but you've hardly mentioned her to me. We've been going out for, I don't know, a little while, and I still can't read you. I don't know what makes you tick or what's important to you. Maybe Mitch and Bernard were right. Maybe I was too private, but it didn't bother me. Alan was one of the few people, okay, the only person, who knew what I was really like on the inside. And that wasn't even by choice. Early in our friendship, he more or less kidnapped me one night after work and whisked me away to a party in a courtyard much like the one behind my loft. We hung out with his friends for hours, talking and laughing. I was more comfortable in the company of his strange, colorful friends than I had been with any other group of people I could remember. Around midnight, someone popped in an old VHS tape of Xanadu, and most everyone flocked to the TV inside. Alan and I stayed outside and talked. Actually, I did most of the talking, answering every one of his myriad questions about my life and childhood as honestly as I ever had. The next morning, nursing a grating headache, I opened Bits and Pieces an hour late, much to a snickering Alan's delight. He admitted there had been a boatload of vodka, cleverly disguised as pineapple juice, in the punch he'd been handing me all night. How else was I going to get you talking? I had almost no idea who you were until last night. I never would have pegged you as a former Bourbon Street bartender in hot pants. I smacked him on the arm and pretended to be put off all day, but he knew better. You had fun, and you know it. You should let your hair down more often. You're much more fun to be around when you're not working so hard to keep all those balls up in the air. Let one fall now and then. The rest of Louisiana and all of Mississippi passed in a blur of concrete, casino billboards, and occasional lingering hurricane damage. When I crossed the state line into Alabama, something clenched in my stomach. I had no idea what the next few days would hold. Being 12 years old when my parents died, I didn't have to take care of anything related to the business of death. Mags had been there to talk to the doctors, the lawyer, the funeral home. I was insulated from the ugliness of it all, except for the savage hole in my heart. When Mags took to her bed after the funeral, Dot stepped in as my surrogate mother. She sent thank you notes to those who had sent food, returned casserole dishes, delivered the funeral bouquets to the hospital, and packed lunches for me when I went back to school. As the only surviving member of our tiny family, I'd likely be responsible for all those particulars. But this time, there wasn't a 12-year-old child in the mix. She had grown into a 30-year-old woman, more than capable of taking care of the details. I arrived at Mr. Baines's office 10 minutes before our scheduled meeting. I approached the door to his office on the 6th floor with a mix of nerves and determination, certain I'd be walking away with nothing more than a few dusty boxes of old clothes and maybe some items belonging to my parents. "Excuse me, it's time to..." Mr. Baines cleared his throat to get our attention. Dot, Bert, Glory, and Major had spent the last 10 minutes oohing and aahing over me. "Your hair is so pretty. It's longer since we saw you last." Glory examined a dark lock between her fingers. Her short dreadlocks stood up at jaunty angles. I just got a new shade of red in last week. Maybe you'll let me try it out on you. Fix you up nice for the funeral. Glory Gregg was the hairdresser at the Hideaway. At one time, she kept the residents' hair in the latest dues deemed acceptable for senior citizens, and a few that would look better on skateboarding teens. Did Miss Mary Lou ever forgive Glory for the bad dye job that left her hair eggplant purple instead of dusky midnight? Major was Glory's Army veteran husband. I never knew if Major was his given name or just his title. I'm making Mag's favorite chicken a la king tonight in her honor. Bert, the chief culinary officer, said. All the residents knew they needed permission before entering the kitchen. Bert was soft-spoken and gentle, but the kitchen was his domain, and he'd let you know if you overstayed your welcome when he needed to start a meal. You'll be at the house for dinner, right? Sure she will, Dot said. I've already gotten the blue room ready for you, dear. Before I could speak, Mr. Bain stood up behind his desk. If I could have everyone's attention, we'll get started. This shouldn't take long, but I don't want to waste anyone's time. He looked down at his watch before he sat and opened a slim folder. As you all know, I've gathered you here for the reading of The Will of Mrs. Margaret Van Buren, better known as Mags. In typical cases, as the estate attorney, I would mail a copy of the will to beneficiaries. However, Mrs. Van Buren specifically requested I gather the five of you to hear the will together. Being a longtime friend of hers, I intend to follow her wishes to the letter. Instead of speaking of the house itself, Mr. Baines began with a list of mundane items. When he started outlining which kitchen items would go to Bert and which quilts Glory could have, I tuned out. My mind drifted back to the day I became a permanent resident of the Hideaway. My parents had dropped me off so they could do some Christmas shopping. It was only September, but they liked to spread the expenses over a few months rather than end the year in the red. As owners of the only diner in town, famous for their loaded cheeseburger and a darn good catfish pie, they made enough money to pay the bills and keep me in my little ponies and then in Converse sneakers, but not much extra rattled in their pockets. It was raining that day. I had curled up in the window seat in the downstairs den, tracing raindrops trailing down the window with my finger when someone knocked on the door. I paused, waiting to hear movement in the house. No one came. So I rose and peered out the window next to the door. Sergeant Burnside, the chief of police in Sweet Bay, and a frequent Jenny's Diner customer, stood on the porch, shaking water off his cap. As he settled the cap back on his head, he noticed me standing in the window. His eyebrows crunched together, and the worry lines on his forehead deepened. When Mags appeared behind me and opened the door, Sergeant Burnside asked if he could talk to Mags in private. I knew it was something terrible. A little while later, Dot found me in my room and gave me the details. The rain, my parents' 1975 Volvo, a huge water oak, slick roads, and flashing lights. The police found a toy store shopping bag 100 feet away, sitting in a horse pasture, like someone had set it down and left it for a child to find, like a present. I hadn't noticed the quiet in the small office overlooking downtown Mobile until Mr. Baines said my name. Now everyone was looking at me. I'm sorry, what did you say? I asked. He looked down at the paper in front of him and read, "To my granddaughter, Sarah Margaret Jenkins, I bequeath the Hideaway and all its contents, save for those already specified for other people. She is to take possession of the house effective immediately. I request that she use her talents and skills to renovate the house and property to its fullest potential, hiring help as necessary, and live in the house during renovations to keep a close eye on the work. Don't let anyone bungle this job." Her words, not mine. Mr. Baines looked up at us. "My friends can stay in the house as long as Sarah owns it," he continued. "After renovations are complete, she may do with the house what is in its and her best interest." Mr. Baines rummaged in a desk drawer, then handed me a manila envelope closed with a metal clasp. Enclosed is the letter she said will explain things in more detail. There's also a copy of the will for your records. I trust any questions you have will be answered fully by the contents therein. We sat in silence as he gathered his things. If no one has any questions, I have a 4 o'clock meeting I need to get to. I'm only a phone call away if you think of anything later. Wait, wait, I held my hand up, unable to grasp what he had just unloaded and not ready to be alone with the others and their questions. That's it? That's all it says? Well, there's the letter, he motioned to the envelope in my still outstretched hand. But I don't understand. I only plan to be in Sweet Bay a week. I can't... She's giving me the house? I looked around at the familiar faces next to me. Did any of you know about this? No, she'd leave you the house, you mean? Dot asked. No, although I suppose it's silly to think that she would have left it to anyone else, especially us. Bert cleared his throat and Major shifted in his chair. Silly? What's so silly about it? Major asked. We're old, Dot said. Why would Mags leave it to us when we're probably not far behind her? It belongs to Sarah, as it should. Maybe, but we've all lived there for decades, Major's voice grew louder. She could have at least given us a say in what happened to the house. Glory rested her small dark hand on Major's beefy one. We're lucky Mags made any plans at all. She loved us, so of course she wants to take care of us. She would never want us turned out on the street. She glanced at me as if looking for confirmation. I opened my mouth, then closed it. My mind was a chalkboard wiped clean. My fingers found the edges of the folded letter inside the envelope. Thank you, Vernon, Dot stood. It's time for us all to go home. We'll eat, then we can talk about everything. She looked at me. We'll see you at the house. I pried open the manila envelope before I even closed my car door. Aside from the copy of the will Mr. Baines mentioned, there were 2 sheets of paper. The first sheet was letterhead from First Coastal Bank with an account number stamped at the bottom. The other was Mag's letter. I peered inside the envelope, expecting it to be empty, but it wasn't. I turned the envelope upside down, and a key slid into my open hand. It was small, the color of an old penny, and almost weightless. Dot and the others were still moseying across the parking lot toward their cars. I pulled the letter out and started reading. Dear Sarah, you're probably wondering why in the world I decided to leave you the bed and breakfast, my refuge, my own hideaway for 50 years, when you've spent years building your own life in New Orleans. But aside from my dear roommates, you are my entire family. Who else could I give the house to? I'm sure at least one of them, probably Major, will disagree, but it's my house, my choice. As Mr. Baines read in the will, my hope is that you will do what you must to make the hideaway beautiful. It was once, long before I stumbled on it, and it's high time someone restored it to what it should have been all along. I let it go to make a point, but my anger has long since dried up. The place deserves to shine again, and you, my dear, are the person to tackle the job. I don't care how you do it. Just give the house back its glory. After that, you can do whatever you want with it. If you decide to sell it, please give my friends enough time to make alternate plans. Don't worry about money. I have an account at First Coastal with your name on it. Use the money to do whatever you need. To say the hideaway is important to me is an understatement. I'll go to my grave carrying memories of both sweet, miraculous love and deep, aching loss in my heart, and the house has been a witness to it all. My highest hope is that somehow it can give you the love and strength it's given me over the years. I trust your vision for the house and for your future. Just remember the two don't have to be mutually exclusive. Love, Mags. Chapter 7, Mags, January 1960. His name was William. He told me a little about himself on our walk. Woodworker. Had some pieces in local shops and galleries. Good at it, but didn't make much money. Never married. I gave him similarly scant details about my own life. Society life in Mobile, balls and parties, married, husband huddled up in a chalet with his lover. "Puts you in a bit of an awkward position now, doesn't it?" he asked. "Awkward?" I laughed. "Of all the positions it puts me in, awkward doesn't come to mind." He just smiled. "What are you doing here?" I asked. "At the hideaway, I mean. You don't live here, do you?" "I do, for the moment at least. I've moved around with buddies the last few years. We were up in Asheville for a while, then down to Florida. I landed in Sweet Bay last year, but just moved in with a charming Mrs. DeBerry a couple of weeks ago." We walked on, down the path in front of us, a family piled into a motorboat, arms overflowing with jackets, blankets, and fishing poles. "And you? What brings you here?" "I told you, my husband left. So I did too." "There's more to it than that. There always is." "You want to hear the whole sad story?" "Well, I don't have anything else to do or anywhere else to be," he smiled. Then his brow creased. "But if it's not something you want to talk about, I understand." I took a deep breath of the damp, cool air and blew it out. "I think it's okay. Being here makes everything that's happened seem, well, a little less crushing. It started before we were even engaged, so I guess you could say we got off on the wrong foot. Robert and I had been going steady for a while when he asked me to be his date to the biggest Mardi Gras ball in Mobile. A mutual friend had seen him downtown weeks earlier outside Zeman's Jewelers, shaking hands with Mr. Zeman himself. Naturally, I expected a ring to come soon, maybe even the night of the ball. Just then, the boat with the little family roared to life. We paused and watched the man back the boat out of its spot alongside a covered pier, then zoom off toward deeper waters. "Let me guess, the ring didn't come," William said, resuming our walk. "Not exactly. I knew Robert was very popular, especially with the girls, but I chose to ignore the rumors. I was content knowing he'd asked me to be his date when he could have asked anyone. In hindsight, I should have paid a little more attention to those rumors. It's always easier to ignore the things we don't really want to know." "Yes, well, it would have saved me some tears if I'd listened." In my mind, I saw the twinkling lights hanging from the ballroom rafters as if they were etched in my brain. The men at the ball were in high spirits, drunk on liquor, excitement, and the look of their ladies in floor-length, sparkling gowns. Every so often, Mother would catch my eye and smile like everything was right with the world. And it was, until Annabelle Whitaker entered the room. "What happened at the ball?" William asked. I shrugged. "He had a problem being faithful, even back then."
"So you left?"
It took me a while, but yes, I left."
"And you could have gone anywhere, gotten in that car and put 1,000 miles between you and your cheating husband, but instead you ended up here, walking beside me.
Life's a funny thing, isn't it?" "Funny?" I asked. "I'm not quite sure that's the right word. I married Robert Van Buren, handsome Robert, who came home from Korea and wanted to get to know his neighborhood pal again. But by that time, I was a woman, no longer the childhood buddy. He courted me, romanced me, and asked me to the ball, then humiliated me in front of all of Mobile. But I married him anyway. Then he did just what I, and probably everyone else in town, expected him to do. And I kept staying. After all, good wives didn't leave their husbands, however unfaithful they were." Without warning, a snort of laughter escaped me. William stopped walking and stared at me, but I kept laughing, unconcerned with whether I was being proper. I laughed until my stomach ached and tears dripped from my chin. I wasn't altogether sure whether those tears were from humor or grief. "Feel better?" he asked when my fit was finally over. "Tons," I wiped my eyes. "I think this place will be good for you." He took my hand. I instinctively tried to pull it away,
But then I thought of Robert and Annabelle on the dance floor at the ball, his hand on her lower back, both of them oblivious to the open-mouthed stares all around them. William's hand was large and warm, and it felt good. You can hide out while you figure out what to do next, but I should warn you, the hideaway tends to make people want to stay. He squeezed my hand, and to my surprise, I squeezed back. Life already felt different. Before heading back into the house for dinner, William took me to his workshop to show me a table he was building. "I'd love to know what you think about it," he said as we crossed the grass between the house and the small woodshed where he did his work. I looked up at him in surprise. Robert rarely asked my opinion about anything other than the doneness of a steak or whether the housekeeper had cleaned the kitchen well enough. The simple fact that William wanted to know what I thought about his work sent a spark of longing through my chest. "You seem like someone who appreciates nice things. It's not perfect, but I think it's kind of nice." He grinned at me and pushed the door open. A table stood in the center of the room, lit by a single light hanging from a cord in the ceiling. I inhaled sharply. With his rough, calloused hands and joking manner, I'd expected something practical and useful, not such beauty. The table was long and slim with oak boards, stained a rich, dark brown. But the best part was the legs. Delicately carved vines and leaves snaked around each one. I knelt and ran my hand down one leg, my fingers following the shallow curves and twists of the carving. "This is beautiful." I looked back up at him. "You sound surprised." I shook my head. He laughed. "It's okay. I've heard it before. I learned carving from my grandfather. He used to whittle sticks into little creatures, bears, dogs, cats. I tried it one day on a scrap piece of wood and discovered I was good at it." He shrugged, then looked around the shop. "I didn't realize it was so messy in here until now. Sawdust covered the floor like dew, and his tools were in disarray on his work surface. In the corner, broken pieces of wood sat in a jumble. I can help you straighten up if you want." "You don't have to do that. I wouldn't want you to get your clothes dirty." I raised an eyebrow. "Suit yourself." He reached behind him and grabbed a broom, then held it out to me. "You can start with this." We got to work. I swept piles and piles of sawdust. The stuff seemed to multiply the more I swept, while he gathered loose boards and stacked them along one wall. It wasn't long before we both grew warm, and William pushed open the door to allow in a breeze. I paused in the open doorway and slipped my feet out of my heels, kicking them to the side. "You'll ruin those in no time," William pointed at my legs covered in pantyhose. "You might as well take them off, too." "What? My stockings?" "If you haven't noticed, you're the only one here who wears those things. Well, you and Mrs. DeBerry." I looked down at my stocking feet. I could see the indentations on the top of my toes where the heels had dug into my skin. My heart beat a little faster as I reached down and pulled the thin silk off one leg at a time. Then I dropped them in a pile on top of my shoes. Lord, if my mother could see me now. With the sweeping finished, I helped him organize his tools in his tool bag and on little hooks stuck into the wall. We worked in easy silence at first. Then we began to talk about his family and mine, about Robert and our marriage. "I remember the night he arrived home from the war," I said. "My parents and his were having dinner at the Battle House Hotel. Robert had his family chauffeur bring him to the dinner. Mother said when he pulled her to the side and asked about me, she knew he was going to propose. She burst into my bedroom late that night and told me all about it. She was so excited about the prospect of marrying me off, especially to the Van Buren family." "What makes them so special?" William asked. "The Van Burens own Southern National Bank downtown. My father is an executive in the shipping industry. It helps my family to have a friend in the banking business, even better if we're married to them." "I see. And did the proposal come quickly?" "Not as quick as Mother would have liked," I smiled. "We'd been friends before, but it wasn't romantic. We had to get to know each other again, but something about him was different, more serious than I remembered. I'd imagine war will do that to a man, William said. I don't know if it was the war or just that he decided it was time for us to be together. Everyone knew it would happen. I was never too comfortable with the idea that his parents and mine decided a long time ago that we'd be a perfect match for each other. I guess I just let myself be pulled along by everyone's excitement. And the fact that Robert was quite charming didn't hurt matters either. Was it ever a perfect match? I suppose in some ways it was, just not in the way I wanted it to be. And what way is that? I laughed a little and smoothed my hair with my hands. My, you are direct, aren't you? I'm just curious about you, that's all. I didn't answer his question. After all, how could you explain true love, the kind that nurtures and respects, that honors and cherishes? That's what I'd hoped for when I married Robert. Even though all the signs pointed to him being unfamiliar with and uninterested in that kind of love. But I hardly knew William, and it felt silly to try to explain my heart. You wanted to be treasured. I guess you could say that, I said, stammering. Instead, I got this life, and a husband I hardly recognize. It's not what I pictured, that's for sure. I looked up to see where he stood in front of the window, framed by the fading light outside. His gaze on me was so intense I had to turn my eyes away. I pushed off from the work table where I'd been scraping spilled paint off the handle of a hammer. I wasn't sure where to look or what to do with my hands. William crossed the floor toward me. When his fingers touched mine, I closed my eyes and exhaled. Big and warm, his hand wrapped around mine. I wanted to close the distance between us with one more step, but propriety held me back. He dropped his gaze to our laced fingers. Just as he opened his mouth to speak, someone called from the house. Dinner! He leaned around me and peered through the window toward the house, then sighed and looked back at me. I think it's time for us to go, he whispered. He held his elbow out to me. May I escort you? I raised an eyebrow and smiled, then bit it back. I nodded and slipped my arm into his. Dinner was a loud jumble of laughter and conversation. Dishes passed down the long table, a wine glass spilled, chairs scraping against the hardwood floor. I tried to keep up with the conversations as well as I could, but William's steady presence next to me scattered my thoughts. My fingers still tingled where he'd held my hand earlier, and I both wanted him to touch me again and was afraid of what might happen if he did. After dinner and dessert, guests drifted away from the table, some to the back porch, some to the parlor where easels had been abandoned almost mid-stroke, and a few to bed. When a couple of women grabbed the remaining plates and dishes and carried them into the kitchen, I pushed my chair back and stood. I should probably go help, I gestured to the open door of the kitchen. I picked up a scraped, clean casserole dish and followed the women out of the dining room. If they thought it strange that a woman they didn't know was helping with the dishes, they didn't say anything. As I washed and wiped, I tried to calm my frenzied mind and racing heart, but it didn't work. Compared to Robert's charm and swagger, William was substantial and strong. Still confident, but there was no boasting, no bluster. But it was more than that. We'd only spent one afternoon together, and already this man knew me in a way Robert never had. I'd been acknowledged, seen, maybe for the first time. The sensation was dizzying. 15 minutes later, I walked out of the kitchen drying my hands on a towel. William still sat at the dining table alone. At that moment, my heart stilled, calm and sure. He smiled and pushed my chair back a few inches with his foot. Instead of sitting down next to him, I turned toward the stairs and began to climb. More than hearing him on the stairs behind me, I felt his presence staying close. When I walked into my bedroom, I left the door open. The next morning, I woke with the sun on my face. I'd left the window curtain open to catch the breeze when the room grew warm during the night. I stretched and smiled, remembering, but I froze when William stirred next to me in bed. "Good Lord, Margaret, what have you done?" But then he wrapped his arms around me and pulled me close to him, whispered into my hair, kissed my neck. Things Robert never did. In that moment, it was easy to forget the previous 3 years had even happened. I felt bold, eager, yet I was scared to speak, scared to break the silence between us that felt almost sacred. I waited, a complicated knot of tension and contentment in my chest. A few minutes later, I couldn't wait any longer. I rolled to my other side and faced him. "I have to tell you something."
"Hmm?"
"My name isn't Helen Parker." He smiled, his eyes still closed.
"I know."
"What do you mean, you know?" "I saw you through the window when you first arrived here. You hesitated when Mrs. DeBerry asked for your name. I thought, now there's a girl who's running from something, or someone. Makes sense that you'd give a different name." "Was that what I was doing? Running? It didn't even feel that way. It felt more like I was arriving."
"So what's your name?" he asked.
"Margaret."
"Margaret?" he repeated.
Just when I thought he'd drifted back to sleep, he spoke again. "Can I call you Maggie? Margaret's a little stuffy." I laughed.
"You can call me whatever you want."
"Okay, Maggie." He propped himself up on one elbow. "Remember what I said yesterday about you being in an awkward position? This is what I meant."
"You'll have to explain that."
"It's awkward because you're going to fall in love with me. Don't laugh. Just wait. It'll happen. Then, when people hear that you left your husband, they're going to say that you're getting back at him by being with me. You'll have to defend yourself to them. Prove to them that this is something other than a rebound." He lay back down next to me. "I am not going to fall in love with you," I said, our faces inches apart.
"You're not?"
He moved his lips closer to mine.
"Nope," I murmured.
He smiled. "Now it's my turn to tell you something. From the moment I got here, I felt like this was where my life would start. My real life. I've done a lot of things and gone a lot of places, but when I arrived here, something felt different." He reached up and stroked my cheek. "I wasn't sure what to look for, but then you showed up. I think you're what I've been waiting for." Silence stretched between us, but it wasn't uncomfortable. Rather, it was a space for dreams, for possibility. Chapter 8, Mags, February 1960. William and I quickly became an item. Everyone in the house saw it, and no one questioned it. Only Mrs. DeBerry thought it improper.
"Mrs. Parker, or whoever you are, it is Mrs., isn't it?"
I nodded.
"Mrs. Parker, he's a bum. They're all bums. They don't do anything. You're a young girl. What would your father think?"
"He'd probably be shocked, Mrs. DeBerry. Just like you are. Even I am, a little.
But William isn't a bum. You should know that."
She shook her head and walked away, mumbling about ladies and gentlemen and indecent things. William introduced me to his friends as Maggie. He looked at me when he said it the first time, as if asking for belated permission. I nodded. Maggie felt good. It felt light. A woman in the house, Daisy, lent me some clothes when she saw me adjusting the waistband of my slim skirt.
"Here, this will be more comfortable." She pulled a long tunic dress out of a bag.
I smiled. Mother would definitely not approve. I stopped rolling my hair that day. I let it fall around my shoulders, free and unruly. That night, I shoved my bobby pins, pearl necklace, and foam rollers into a side pocket of my suitcase. I went ahead and dropped my wedding ring down there with them.
Lord, it was a sad, expensive little collection.
The days were long, with nothing concrete to mark the passage of time. Most mornings, William and I sat among the other guests in the dining room, munching on croissants and idly reading the newspaper. No one had real jobs to hurry off to, so the mood in the house was one of utter relaxation. It wasn't hard to slip into a routine of ease. As the painters painted, the sculptors sculpted, and the yogis practiced their moves in the grass, I learned the routines of the house and became a part of them. Since I didn't have a creative endeavor to take up my time like everyone else, I wanted a job to do, something to make me feel useful and productive. Starla, the woman I'd seen in the kitchen the first night I arrived, asked me to help with food preparations. She just needed an extra hand to help pull meals together. But I took it a step further. I made a grocery list every few days with ingredients for each meal, plus extra items for the house. Toilet paper, matches, soap. I organized the pantry by food type and size. I scoured the oven and cleaned out the refrigerator. As a wedding gift, Mother had hired a woman to clean our house in Mobile twice a week, so I rarely had anything to clean or straighten at home. The hard work felt good, and I relished my sore muscles and dirty fingernails. William and I spent most evenings sitting on the back porch, huddled together on the glider. He'd massage my feet and tell me stories of working in orange groves in Florida and selling his tables and benches from a roadside shack in Asheville. My privileged prior life was sedate and sheltered compared to William's hard-earned wisdom and tales from the road. I soaked him up, every word, laugh, and touch. He knocked on my door early one morning before the sun was up. He stuck his head in the room when I answered. "Come with me," he whispered, holding up a mug of coffee. "Outside, 5 minutes." Curious, I dressed quickly. Following the aroma of coffee outside, I found him waiting in his truck, the passenger door open for me. "Where are we going? It's still dark." "I know. You'll see." He drove fast down Highway 55. When he turned onto a side street, I grew lost in a maze of dirt roads and creek beds. Finally, we went around a bend, and the path opened into a cove overlooking Mobile Bay, isolated except for a blue heron standing on thin legs in the shallow water. It was still dark beneath the cover of trees, but directly in front of us, the sky had exploded in streaks of orange and pink, with violet clouds scattered like pebbles. Just above the waterline, the horizon remained a deep indigo blue. Seagulls gliding in the air provided the only movement other than the quiet waves creeping forward and back along the shore. We watched the sky change colors without speaking. At some point during the show, we walked to the edge of the water and sat down, a blanket over our shoulders and our toes just touching the water. I leaned my head on his shoulder. "What do you think?" he asked, once the sky was a solid fluorescent orange. "It's breathtaking. How did you find this place?" "It's mine. I bought this plot of land from a buddy who moved to San Francisco. It had been in his family for generations, but he didn't plan to come back, and he said he didn't need ties here. I've done nothing but move around, and I guess ties are what I'm looking for. Something to anchor me to a place I can call my own." We sat close and still, watching the gulls overhead and the water's gentle movement. In the distance, the double masts of a shrimp boat interrupted the perfect line of the horizon. He took my hand in his and traced the skin on my palm and wrist up to the crook of my elbow. The light touch sent chills up my arms and down my back. He laced his fingers between mine, and I pressed myself into his side. It had been a little more than a month since we met, but already I felt connected to him in a way I'd never felt with Robert. This thing that's happening between us, it's fast. I was scared to say the words out loud, so I whispered them. "Too fast?" He turned to face me. I shook my head. "I don't know. I don't even know how this sort of thing works. I've never been with anyone other than Robert, and we'd known each other for years. Is it possible, rational, for us to feel so much so quickly?" "Sure it's possible. Rational? I don't know, and I don't care. I care about us and where we're going," How do I know this isn't a rebound, like you said? I touched the tip of his nose. And how do I know you're not just taking advantage of the only woman at the hideaway, not dressed in black and ranting about Kerouac or Ginsburg? He didn't laugh or even smile. I'm not taking advantage of you. You know me well enough by now to know that. That's the thing. Sometimes I feel like I don't know you at all. You do know me. He pulled away a bit. What else do you need to know? My life before you wasn't that interesting. Then you showed up and my world cracked open. Isn't that enough? It is, or I want it to be, but you have to understand how it feels to open the door to a world that's entirely unknown to me, and I stopped. I didn't want to remind him, or me, as if either of us could forget. And what? I'm still married. I have a husband. You're right, he said softly, his gaze on the water. Do you have plans to return to him? I shook my head. Then this new world, I know it makes you nervous, but isn't it also a little exciting? He cupped my cheek with his hand. We can make our future anything we want it to be. The corner of his mouth pulled up, the same half smile he offered as a life preserver the first evening I arrived at the hideaway. It almost made me mad. That smile that seemed to belittle my fears of linking my future to someone and somewhere else. But at the same time, I wanted to cling to that smile, to wrap myself around the unknown and not ask questions. And as for this just being a rebound for you, he continued, a way to get back at Robert for his lady friend, you'll have to judge that for yourself. I don't think it is, though. I think this is something else. I nodded, and he took my hand. Let's not mention Robert again. I don't want him to be a part of this, I said. Suits me just fine. I nestled back down beside him under the blanket. He pulled me closer and kissed me. I told you you were going to fall in love with me, he said with a grin. I pushed him away and laughed. What makes you think I'm in love with you? You are, aren't you? I was a new woman, risky and adventurous. It felt foreign and perfect at the same time. I guess you'll have to wait and see. Chapter 9, Sarah. April. I pulled down the long gravel driveway in front of the hideaway and began the slow trek through the trees. When I reached the house, I parked my car under the big oak. Nerve stalled my hand on the car door handle. My parents' death and the lonely years after had left a wound deep in my heart. Although the wound had healed, it was still tender. I didn't let myself think of their deaths often. It was too painful, like pressing on a bruise. Thankfully, my scrambling to open bits and pieces and make a name for myself in New Orleans occupied almost all my mental energy. Their absence was always present, but most of the time I was able to keep it tucked under the surface of my life. I was comfortable with that. I could live with that. But here I was, back at the place where it all happened. When I finally exited my car, I stood in the driveway holding my suitcase and picking rocks out of my open-toed sandals. I heard the crunch of gravel and turned around to see Major's car slowing to a stop behind me. I waited by the door while the four of them climbed out. "Go on in," Major said. "You don't need to wait for an invitation." "I still can't believe y'all leave the doors unlocked." "It's not New Orleans, honey," Dot said, before kissing me on the cheek and walking past me into the house. I took a deep breath before following them in. Major pulled out my chair at the table before I sat down. Dot and Glory must have done a number on him on the ride over from Mobile. He seemed calm, but I could only imagine the rant he probably unleashed in the car. I glanced around, trying to gauge the tension level, as Bert filled our glasses with iced tea. "We're real glad you're here," Glory said to me, spooning out a serving of green beans. I laughed a little, but her calm, delicately lined face told me she was serious. "I thought y'all might fight over who got to kick me out the door first." You're like a daughter to us, Glory said. Kicking you out would never cross our minds. All we can do is look to the future of the house, whatever that may be.
Four pairs of eyes shifted in my direction. I took a long sip of tea.
I meant what I said earlier, Dot said as I set my glass down.
The house belongs to you now, as it should.
Mags asked you to take care of this place, and no one could ever argue with her once she got an idea in her head, regardless of what you decide to do with the house in the end.
She's not going to sell the thing, that's for sure, Major's deep voice burst out. It needs to stay in family hands.
He shot to his feet, his chair squeaking on the hardwood, and stomped to the other side of the room. So much for him cooling off in the car.
He stood at the window overlooking the driveway for a long moment before he turned back to us. When he did, most of the anger had drained from his face.
I know we don't deserve the house. Blood's thicker than water and all that, but after living here so long and being with Mags every day, I'd say we're a little more than just water.
Now she's gone and given our house to someone who only visits a couple of times a year.
He lifted his glasses and rubbed the bridge of his nose. He sighed.
I know it's not our house, but it feels that way.
It does feel that way, but Sarah grew up in this house, Dot said.
It's more hers than ours.
Mags let us stay here so long out of the kindness of her heart and because she loved us. But she's not forcing us out. She wouldn't have given the house to Sarah if she didn't trust Sarah to make the best decision. I agree with her on this.
Silence fell in the room as Major shuffled back to his chair and we all started eating. Forks clinked against plates and a breeze from the open window ruffled the curtains.
Dot looked at Bert and tilted her head toward the kitchen.
Bert raised his eyebrows and nodded.
I'll be right back.
A moment later, he returned carrying a bottle of wine and a tray of glasses.
Nothing like a little wine to loosen the lips and calm the nerves, right?
I think someone's lips are already loose enough, Glory said.
Bert started to laugh but stopped when Major glared at him.
Okay, let's all just enjoy our dinner, Dot said.
We need to speak words of love to each other and celebrate who Mags was, not second-guess her actions. It's her life. Her house, her decision.
I looked down at my lap and smiled. Dot was Mag's best friend in the world. It made sense that she would echo what Mags had said in her letter to me.
Everybody agree?
We all nodded.
Glory winked at me from across the table. I smiled back at her.
Everyone watched as Bert uncorked the bottle and poured a couple of inches into each glass.
His calm movements soothed our frayed nerves. One by one, everyone reached over and took a glass, even Major.
I waited until everyone had taken a sip before I spoke.
It means a lot that Mags trusted me with her home. In all of our conversations, she never said anything about leaving the house to me. If she wanted to surprise me, she did it. I have a lot going on with my shop and...
Yes, your shop, Glory said.
Did you see the binder by the couch when you came in?
She always kept it in her bedroom, but we brought it out so you could see it.
She has every magazine article that has ever mentioned you or bits and pieces. She showed that binder to everyone who came through the door. She was so proud of you.
I always told Mags when a magazine writer or reporter came into the shop with a voice recorder and a notebook telling me we'd been noticed again by another editor somewhere. Sometimes I worried she'd think that I was flaunting my success, but she always celebrated with me. I had no idea she'd gone to the trouble of tracking down the magazines and clipping the articles.
Sarah, you have quite a talent, and we...
Dot bored a hole in Major with her eyes. Think you'll be the perfect person to whip this place into shape. I, for one, am glad for it. A few cans of paint and a hammer or two are just what we need around here.
From the little I'd seen before dinner, painting and hammering were the least of my concerns. If I decided to sell the house, and living 3 hours away, did I have another choice? I'd have to do a lot of work just to get it ready for the market. Talking about selling right now was premature, but finding a good contractor wasn't.
I'll check everything out, put a plan together, and start calling around, I said.
I'm good at cosmetic updates, but I'm no expert on plumbing, wiring, or any of that. Now, don't get too ahead of yourself, dear, Dot said. The house doesn't need that much work. She's still a beauty, much like your grandmother. She just needs some spit and polish. We'll start there and see how it goes, I said carefully. And have you thought of your plans for the house aside from the renovation, Gloria asked.
I knew what she was really asking.
I haven't thought about much, honestly. It's been a quick couple of hours. Just give us some warning if you decide to pull the rug out from under us, Major said. Mag specifically asked me to do that. Even if she hadn't, you know I wouldn't do that to you. With dinner mostly over, Bert stood to get the dessert. Someone dropped off a hummingbird cake this morning. I've been holding myself back all day. So many people have been bringing food by, Glory said. Such kindness.
I didn't know Mags had so many friends, I said.
Most everyone in Sweet Bay has been helped by Mags at one time or another, Bert said. Either that or their parents were. Anyway, this is what Southern people do, whether they know the deceased or not. You know that. He set the cake down in the center of the table as if he'd made it himself. If it's okay with you, I'm going to pass on dessert, I said. I think I'll walk around a little before heading upstairs.
You sure you don't want any? You're not one of those girls who never lets herself eat sweets, are you? Bert asked.
If nothing else, that's what grief is for. You can stuff yourself silly and blame it on the person who died.
Bert, that's terrible, Dot said.
I'm just kidding, and Sarah knows it. But we do have a counter full of cakes and pies in the kitchen. Someone will have to eat it all.
I'll have a slice tomorrow, I said as I stood.
Let us know if you need anything, Dot said. Your room is all ready, but I may have forgotten something. Feel free to look around. Go on down to the dock, whatever you want. The place is yours.
Sure is, Major said under his breath. She's got the keys to prove it.
I spent the next hour walking around the house and yard to get a sense of what a renovation would entail. Of course, I'd seen the house each time I'd come back for visits, but I hadn't taken a hard look at it with a critical eye. Inside, it was hard to get a sense of the space because most of the rooms were overstuffed with furniture, as if each person who'd moved into the house over the years had added a treasured chair or table to the mix. The resulting hodgepodge of furniture matched neither each other nor the style of the house. A few pieces stuck out, though, and for good reason. An oak pie safe with hand-punched tin covering the bottom shelves. An armoire with delicate scrollwork carved into the pine at the top and bottom. And a corner hutch covered in peeling white paint and doors with squares of wavy glass. These had been in the house for as long as I could remember, but before, they'd just been part of the overall chaos of the house. Now I saw they bore the handmade vintage charm so many of my customers craved. The main living room had floor-to-ceiling curtains that, when opened, revealed beautiful windows reaching almost to the ceiling. I tied the curtains back on their hooks and peered through the salt-crusted glass. Past the lawn, the bay stretched out flat and calm. As I turned to cross through the room, a blur of blue on the floor caught my eye. I knelt and ran my fingers across the splotch of what appeared to be blue paint just inside the front door. I scratched at the edge with my fingernail, but the paint was so old it had almost blended in with the wood. Across the hall from the living room, the kitchen had last seen an update in the 1980s. The countertops and backsplash still boasted the cheery yellow Mags had loved so much. Laminate cabinets with faux wood trim and ancient appliances rounded out the dated look. Baskets hung everywhere, adding a country feel that must have been Bert's doing. Despite this veneer of age, the house had great bones. I couldn't help but feel a ripple of excitement as I walked the wide center hallway from the front door straight through to the porch in the back. 12-foot ceilings, tall windows, hardwood floors, curved staircase. These were the things of a designer's dream. I moved outside to the yard. The house had been built with boards salvaged from an old barn in Virginia, or so the story went that I'd heard as a kid. Mags used to tell me If I looked hard enough, I could find places in the wood where goats had rubbed their horns or chickens had pecked, leaving small holes and dings. I never did find those places, but I spent whole afternoons looking for them. Mags probably told me that story just to occupy me while she worked in her garden. But now, as I looked at the facade of the house, it wouldn't have surprised me if it was true. Most of the wood was pockmarked with holes the diameter of a number 2 pencil, although they were probably due to industrious carpenter bees, not farm animals. A thin layer of peeling paint covered the grass at the base of the house. Fungus green peeked out where the paint had peeled from the weathered wood. Kudzu, that great southern beast, covered the entire chimney and one upstairs window. On the chimney, crumbly bricks at both the base and top made use of the inside fireplace impossible, or at least dangerous. Much of what I saw remained exactly as it had been for as long as I could remember. The house had always been a little disheveled, but I was used to it and didn't question it much. Now, standing in the grass facing the house, I wondered about the general sense of deterioration and neglect that covered the house like a shroud. Mags had let the house slip into disarray for a reason. She said so in the letter, but any hint of anger in her had been lost on me. Whatever her reason, my fingers itched for a paint scraper, sheet of sandpaper, or bottle of wood glue. If I didn't have a life in New Orleans and a business to get back to, I knew I could make something of the hideaway. Mags was right. The beauty was there. It just needed someone with a trained eye and good taste to uncover it. But the project would require a much longer duration in Sweet Bay than I had anticipated. What would happen to bits and pieces if I'd stayed away for too long, unable to offer input on items purchased and sold, decorating decisions, and customers' urgent requests? Later that night, I sank into bed in the blue room without changing clothes or even washing my face. The crisp sheets were cool against my legs, and a breeze through the open window lifted the curtains. Dot called it the blue room because everything in it was varying shades of blue. The bedding, curtains, rugs, even the framed prints on the wall. Each of the bedrooms in the hideaway had its own color scheme. My blue room, the yellow room, the pink room, and a red room that I'd always thought was a little creepy. I bunched up the pillows behind my head and surveyed the room where I spent so many nights as a kid. It still felt familiar despite having spent only a handful of nights here over the last several years. I'd already checked the closet. It still held some of the clothes I hadn't gotten around to packing up and taking back to New Orleans with me. Earlier, I'd run my fingers across the polo shirts and 2 small blue jeans. Despite making a life for myself elsewhere, I felt like the last 8 years in New Orleans hadn't even happened, except now I was Sarah Jenkins, owner of Bits and Pieces, with a client list as long as my arm. I wore Nanette Lepore and Tory Burch instead of cutoffs and flip-flops. I'd been intentional for nearly a decade, working my butt off to be successful, but back in the blue room, it felt like nothing had changed. Like all my hard work had just been spit and polish. Alan will know what to do. He loved to dole out advice to anyone within earshot, whether she asked for it or not. Occasionally, his words of wisdom were too risky or downright scandalous for my taste. But underneath the sass, his pointers were always spot on. Working together for